Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As scientists learn more about genetics, do we need a new definition of heredity? How is it that over the last few generations we've gotten taller and smarter? Award-winning New York Times columnist and science writer Carl Zimmer is the first journalist to have his whole genome sequenced and analyzed. His new book is called She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. SDPP's Kara Hetland, host of In the Moment's Innovation, spoke with the author.
Well, yeah, I think I just thought of it kind of casually as just the stuff that you somehow inherit from your parents that makes you who you are. And I didn't really think about it in any sort of deep way beyond, you know, what you learn in high school about Mendel and so on, until I started doing research for my own reporting and for this book, really starting to discover all the sort of counterintuitive and marvelous ways in which heredity actually works, whether it's with genes or whether it's with cells that are sort of moving in reverse from children to parents, or whether it's bacteria that can be passed from parents to their offspring. Culture is even inherited. And so it was just a fascinating experience to sort of watch heredity kind of expand in front of me into this much more rich, surprising thing.
And so it's kind of gone from being the word heredity to the word genetics. Is that a fair leap?
Well, you know, heredity comes from the Latin hereditas, which was basically how a person legally inherited all the rights and privileges that from someone else when they died. And so that could include the right to a house or to treasure or what have you, or to slaves even. And for a long time, that was really mainly how people talked about the word. But in the 1800s, scientists really began to think seriously about why it was that children resembled their parents, why there were traits that seemed to travel down in families. And they would say, well, it must be heredity, whatever that is. And so in the early 1900s, the science of genetics was born through a hunt for an explanation for heredity. The problem was that people were very quick to say, aha, problem solved. We figured it all out. And some were even willing to say, well, clearly every trait that we care about must be encoded by just one gene. So there were even people who would claim that all of the differences in intelligence between people must be responsible due to just one gene. And you could trace it through families, and therefore, in order to make society a better place, they wanted to prevent some people from passing down their genes. And in fact, laws were passed to sterilize them. So genetics is part of the answer to the question, what is heredity? But I'd argue it's not the complete answer.
It's more than. Is there a complete answer? Or are we still learning?
We are still learning, and you know, there are some things that may represent another channel of heredity, and maybe that's true in some species and not others. So, for example, culture. In the book, I talk about how culture really does act like another channel of heredity, passing down things from one generation to the next in terms of information. And it, for our species, it's just as powerful or even more powerful than our genes in terms of what we pass down. But we humans are very unusual in having this kind of inherited culture. It really doesn't work that way in other species. Other species, even bees, can learn from each other, but they can't teach each other, and they can't build on what they learn and come up with new things and new innovations. So we are a very special species, and I would argue that, you know, the reason that we domesticated crops and produced civilizations and had an industrial revolution, all comes down to cultural inheritance.
So I must have written down at least 10 times in my notes, nature versus nurture, ? that is there a difference in how you're brought up and how you're treated as to how your genetics or your, you know, your inherited traits continue?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Genes can influence many different traits, but how you turn out is very much also a result of the environment you're in. In fact, the effect of your genes can change depending on that environment. So I had my DNA sequenced as part of the research for this book. Among other things, I learned that I have a mutation in a gene called FTO, and it's a very common mutation, and on average, people who have my mutation are a few pounds heavier than people who don't. But it turns out that this is not true with people with this mutation who were born, you know, in the 1940s or earlier, and the reason is that our diet has changed. So we're in this new environment where, you know, we eat lots of carbohydrates, lots of sugar, lots of fat, and so on. We eat a very different diet now. And in that environment, it seems that having this particular mutation makes you at greater risk of being somewhat heavier. It's a greater risk for obesity and other things. So, we inherit genes, but what those genes mean to us, they only take on their meaning when you look at our environment.
Take me to that moment where you made the decision to have your genetic sequence.
Well, you know, lots of people are you know, going to 23andMe or Ancestry.com, you know, millions, I should say, to get their DNA sequence. I had a different experience, which was that a geneticist who I knew, Robert Green at Harvard, he sent me an email because he was organizing a meeting about genomes and medicine. And one of the features was that people who went to the meeting got to pay extra to have their whole genome sequenced and for geneticists to look at it and interpret it for them. And I said, wow, like I never thought that we would reach the time where someone would say offhandedly, hey, you want your genome sequenced? You know, in the 1990s, that was like a moonshot. Yeah. And here we are just casually talking about it. So I got my genome sequenced, and then, you know, I wanted to write about it, but first I really wanted to talk with a genetics counselor because I've got kids, and, you know, I don't think it would be fair to them to sort of be blabbing on about serious conditions that that may be an issue for them as well. Turns out I have a pretty boring genome in that respect, thank goodness. I wasn't divulging anything in terms of that. What I did was I got the raw data and then went to scientists and said, you know, let's dive really deep and take a look at what's in here and see some of the interesting things I've inherited from my ancestors. And so that became a big, fascinating journey.
The way you write in this book, it's all about linking different stories together. It's really fascinating stories and storytelling, and not really boring science. Talk about that style here for your readers.
Well, when I write books, you know, my goal is not to be writing textbooks, and I got nothing wrong, nothing against textbooks. I've written a couple myself, but I think that when you're going to write a book for a broad audience, you need to look for the stories that carry forward the lessons that you've learned through your research. And the great thing about heredity is there are just so many stories. In fact, there are an abundance of stories. I mean, I actually would cut back on the stories I was going to include in the book because there are just so many that you want to include them all. But, you can, you know, for example, I wanted to talk about the point at which in the mid-1900s when people started to recognize that you could determine whether someone was a parent of a child simply by looking at their DNA. And this was really not something that people could get their heads around. For centuries, they basically, there'd been a legal standard just to look at a child and see, say, well, does that child look like this person? That was literally the legal standard. And actually, Charlie Chaplin was in this dispute with a woman who claimed that her child was his daughter. And he used blood type to try to disprove that in the 1940s. And actually, he lost the case. Even though he was completely right on the biology, he lost the case because people simply couldn't believe that genetics could be like that. And so, you know, rather than just talking about the details of paternity testing, you know, you can tell the story through this crazy, lurid, amazing, headline-grabbing story about Charlie Chaplin in the 1940s. And there are just lots of stories like that that made this book a lot of fun to write.
Well, and then you went into the stories of they said, no way can this child be your child. And the doctor said, but I was there. I was there when it came out of her.
So this has to do with chimeras, which it's almost like heredity going in the wrong direction. You know, we think of you know, ourselves as you know, being made up of cells that all descend from one fertilized egg, but that's not always the case. We can be made of mixtures of cells that have different origins. And so in the case that you just mentioned, this was a woman who was required to have genetic testing in order to claim welfare benefits for raising her children. But when they tested the children, they told her they didn't match her DNA that they got from, you know, drawing blood. And she said, well, of course they're my children. I mean, I literally was there when they were born. They're like, nope, these are not your children. And they started suggesting that she was committing some kind of fraud. And she was pregnant and actually gave birth to another child. And there was actually, you know, a government official was there for the delivery. And they did the same test on this child and said, nope, this isn't yours either. So this was totally bizarre and Kafkaesque, and it took a while to really figure out that what was happening was that this woman had been a twin, and you know her twin in the womb had died or been absorbed into her body. We don't know what, but in any case, her body was now made up of two populations of cells, and her blood cells came from one population. And her eggs came from another population. They did not match. They looked like they were different people, even though they were integrated into one person. And so I think stories like chimeras really force us to think more broadly about what heredity is and what it allows. You also have other chimeras who are mothers who have absorbed some of the cells from their children when they were fetuses. These cells go into their body and they take on the form of their tissues, like their brains. So you can actually find neurons in some women's brains that came from their children, and they became neurons in their brain. So, you know, that's almost like heredity running in reverse.
Yeah, it blew my mind, actually. And so where are the ethics? Where are all the ethics around what we learn and what we know?
I think that, we think about heredity. I mean, it's a very ethically charged subject. I mean, you know, one of the reasons I think that in the United States there's a flat-out ban on research on modifying human embryos is because we feel that if anyone were to dare tamper with heredity, that would be this horrible moral affront. And I don't think we really think that through very much, because the fact is that there are diseases that are passed down through genes from one generation to the next. And scientists are developing ways to change DNA, and they would be able to, in effect, remove those diseases from heredity. Is that wrong? Should we not do that simply because heredity is this sacred thing that cannot be touched? You know, I think we really need to to talk about that more deeply and talk about the benefits and the risks of these things rather than just saying, this should never be touched.
Well, and being a surrogate mother as well, I mean, and then your body is absorbing something else, and then can you pass that on if you have your own child?
Yes, that's absolutely a very interesting point, which is that surrogate mothers, we kind of think of them as being separate from the fetuses that they carry because they're genetically different, because there's no genetic connection through heredity between mother and child. But if you're a surrogate mother, there is a very good chance that you may become a chimera with this child that you're carrying. So you may very well end up later on with genes from this child. They become a part of you. So, you know, I think the barriers that we think of in terms of heredity are more porous than we may realize.
You talk in the book about, you know, plants and animals and humans, but the human is obviously the most complex. But where do you see all of this research and where we're at today? Where do you see the research taking us?
Well, you know, I think that we're going to get a much richer view of how heredity shapes us. You know, even something as simple as how tall we are, you know, it turns out to be the result of thousands of genes interacting with each other in remarkable ways to guide the growth of our bodies. I think that at the same time, we are going to learn more about other kinds of heredity, whether it's culture, maybe what's known as epigenetics, which is like the control of genes. And these will offer us not just new, deeper understanding of our heredity, but new opportunities to maybe guide it in different directions. Maybe we'll just decide not to touch human heredity, but, you know, it might offer us other ways to manipulate our crops for the food we eat.
And why are some genes turned on and others turned off, and that kind of thing? I talk often with a geneticist here who's doing the Netherlands twin study, identical twins, and he's trying to understand why in identical twins some genes are turned on and some are off, and following
right,
them through their life.
Yeah, and you know, this is kind of sometimes referred to as epigenetics, and it's a fascinating area of research. I think epigenetics has sort of taken on a life of its own, where people will promise you that you can change your epigenetics by doing yoga or buying some food or whatever. We really don't know that much about epigenetics to make such claims, and there's much more we don't understand than what we do understand. And whether or not epigenetics is passed down through the generations is a fascinating question I talk about in my book. The evidence is very strong for plants. So if you're a plant, yeah, epigenetics is a big deal. And that's exciting because it actually means that experience can influence heredity. So that, say, a plant that experiences a drought, it's going to pass on certain traits to its offspring that are going to be carried on through many generations because of that experience. Is that true in humans? You know, the scientists I talk to really are very skeptical that there's much solid evidence for it.
And as you have completed this book, what did you have surprises? Were you kind of knew where you were going through your research, or where are you headed next in all of this?
Well, you know, I mean, right now I'm sort of continuing on in my role as a journalist, as a columnist at the New York Times. One of the things that was really exciting working on in the book was following researchers who are pulling DNA out of fossils, human fossils, Neanderthal fossils, and rewriting the history of our species as a result. And I talk about that in the book. But, you know, the science doesn't stop. It keeps moving forward. And so, you know, even this week, I'm writing about a new paper on, more fossils with DNA coming out of them that are forcing us to revise how we think about another chapter of human history. So the search continues.
Carl Zimmer, I want to thank you for taking time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.